with Professor Charles Arnold Matthews of the College of Business. This will be part of the project that we're doing on the Fisher School of Accounting here at the university. And I'm just going to test now the quality of our voices. Arnold, when were you born?
May 1960.
Where?
Charlie Hope, in Brunswick County, Virginia.
I'm just going to see. All right, everything sounds good on the tape, so we'll get started now. As I indicated, we're doing this for the Fisher School of Accounting project, and we're doing the interview in my office here at the museum. And this is March 1993. You'll put in the proper date here. And I'm going to move ahead now with Professor Arnold's Matthews's interview. You say you were born May 6, 1916?
Yes.
Now, once again, where were you born in Virginia?
The little town, rural town of Charlie Hope, which consisted of four or five families.
Charlie Hope? How do you spell that, Arnold?
C-H-A-R-L-I-E, capital H-O-P-E.
Is there a story behind the name of that town?
Charlie hoped it would become a big city.
It hoped to become a big city. So that's what happened to him. Was there a real Charlie there, or was it named for you, Charles Arnold?
I was not named for the town either.
I thought you were born in Lawrenceville.
That's as close as town of any size.
So that's where you went for mail and whatever.
No, originally we got our mail from Charlie Hope on a rural route.
What part of Virginia is that in?
Section known as South Side.
What's it near? West, east?
It's on the southern border of Virginia, between Richmond and Raleigh.
Are you, you're of course a native Virginian. What about the family, Arnold?
Sam, the furthest we can trace our Matthews family is two generations back of me with Charles Matthews, who was my grandfather.
He came from where?
He was my great-grandfather.
He came from where?
We don't know.
Presumably from the British Isles?
Well, the family originated in the British Isles. But when and who was the first to come to America, we don't know.
Do you know about when the first?
No.
So you don't know about any ancestor participating in the Civil War?
Civil War, yes. Revolutionary War, I don't think so.
Who in the Civil War? Grandfather?
No, grandfather did not. Great-grandfather did not. And there were some cousins on my mother's side of the family that participated in the Civil War.
Arnold, what
people
was your...
by the name of Epperson and Peoples.
Epperson and Peoples. What was your father's name?
My father's name was James Edward Matthews, Sr.
And your mother's name?
That is Sue Epperson.
Epperson. That's with a double P?
Yes.
Is that an old Virginia family also?
To the best of my knowledge.
So you grew up in Charlie Hope? And what business was your father in?
Farmer.
You lived down in the rural areas?
Yes.
What'd y'all grow?
Tobacco, the major money crop. A few cattle, hay, corn. Just general farmer.
Where'd you go to school before you went to college?
Went to grammar school at Charlie Hope, first through seventh grade, and high school in Lawrenceville. Through four grades.
How'd you get to Lawrenceville?
School bus.
And was this a one-room schoolhouse? This
Lawrenceville was...
No, I'm talking about elementary school in Charlie Hope.
No, we had seven grades. As I recall, the first year I went, there was a high school section there also. But, and in the first grade, we were picked up by a horse-drawn wagon that took us to school. And in second grade, my brother, older brother, was responsible for driving the one-horse wagon with a canvas top like the schooners that went to the West Coast, except it was only one horse instead of two or four. And then I think around the third or fourth grade, we began to ride a motorized school bus to school.
Arnold, as you remember back on your childhood and growing up years, was that a happy time for you?
Yeah.
You worked on the farm?
I did.
Doing everything that a farm boy is supposed to do?
From milking the cows before breakfast until to, again, after I got home from school.
Was this a large family? You mentioned a brother.
I had two brothers and a sister.
Were you the youngest?
No, I was second oldest.
So you had some responsibility then for the kids younger than you?
Yes, I guess you could say that.
You went to Washington and Lee for your undergraduate work?
Yeah.
Why Washington and Lee?
Sam, the only thing I can tell you is that's where I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Why I wanted to do that, I'm not sure.
Now, you get there about when? In the 30s?
In 1933.
Three, yeah. You get your degree in 1937, a BS degree. What was your major areas there?
I'm not sure we really had majors. If I had one, it would have been finance.
Mm-hmm. That's been, of course, your major area of study ever since.
Yeah.
Were you fraternity?
No.
Did you work on campus?
Yes.
Were you, would you be considered a poor boy?
I think at Washington and Lee, I would have been considered a poor boy. In Lawrenceville, I was not considered a poor boy.
Now, this period we're talking about is the Depression era. How did it impact your family?
I'm not sure, Sam, it had a great deal of effect on my family. We always had plenty to eat, clothing to wear, adequate housing.
When you got to the campus, of course, the NYA was already in operation as a national program. Did you work for the NYA or did you work while you were a student?
Yes. Worked for the NYA and... I'm not sure it was already in effect when I went to school, but it was in effect shortly after that, and I, of course, looking for every little penny I could find, made application to participate in the program.
What'd you do as a student?
I ran messages and errands for the dean's office.
How good a student were you, Arnold?
I was a B student.
What made you decide to go to graduate school?
It seemed at the time, Sam, to offer the best prospects for the kind of things I was interested in.
And they were what?
I don't know if I ever sat down to analyze them very carefully. Opportunities for teaching for government work, for business.
You were able to get that DME in 1 year. That's pretty quick. 38.
Well, I was a full-time student, and I guess I just put most of my efforts into my studies.
Why the University of Virginia?
I didn't make a decision to go on to graduate school until well into the summer after I graduated from college. And it was one of the few places that had scholarships available. And I was offered one of these and accepted.
Were you getting encouragement from your family to go on to study, or did your dad want you to come back home and go to work?
He left it entirely up to me. But put no pressure on me to come home and go to work. The only go to work he could offer would be farming, and obviously that was not what I prepared myself for.
Were you the only member of the family to go to college?
No, I was the first of my immediate family. But my younger brother went to college and followed me at Washington Lee and went through law school at Washington Lee.
But your older brother did not elect to go to college.
He did not. And my sister, who was the youngest in the family, also went to college.
Were your parents college graduates?
No.
Were you then the first of your family to matriculate?
Yes.
That was a big undertaking in the 1930s for most American families.
It was. I had a first cousin or two who had gone to college, but not in my immediate family.
What about, what was your program of study at Virginia when you were working on the MA? Once again, was this in finance?
No, this was mostly in general economics.
Did you have to write a master's thesis?
Yes.
What was it?
You're going to have to let me feel that.
All right. I was going to ask you whether that was later published. Did that become the basis for a book?
No. It was on it had to do with governmental finance at the local level in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. After you received the MA in 1938, you went immediately into the PhD program at Virginia.
Yes.
Is there any factors which motivated that?
Well, it seemed to be the desirable thing to do if I was going to take advantage of the opportunities which advanced studies offer.
Were you already beginning to think in your own mind that you wanted to end up as a professor, a teacher?
I think so. And this is pretty much what I had decided.
How gregarious a guy were you in those early years?
How what?
How gregarious? Were you a social animal? Were you involved in athletics?
I went out for football the first year I was at Washington and Lee, but I did not really participate in a lot of athletics. I would say I was a fairly social person, but this was not the objective.
But you did not lead a monastic life?
No. I went to the dances.
And participated in the social activities on the campus?
Yes.
How far was the University of Virginia from home?
About 100, 125 miles.
So I guess in those days you were not able to commute back and forth easily.
Christmas holidays, spring holidays, summer.
Did you have a car?
No.
Most college students did not have cars in those years.
That's right.
And you had to either thumb your way or go by bus.
That's right. I did both.
So did I. When you get out of college in 1941, Arnold, the war has started, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You got out in June and Pearl Harbor is in 41. But the war has been on in Europe for a couple of years. Did that seem an imminent threat to you?
Frank, it was a threat before I got out of college. The draft, first draft act was passed in, if I remember correctly, 1940. And I was in school at the University of Virginia on a leave of absence from West Virginia University, where I had taught 1 year. And when the draft numbers were assigned, I was 17, 18, 19, somewhere a relatively low draft number. Plus the fact I was from a rural county and unmarried, which meant that I had a high vulnerability for being drafted into the Army. And after considerable, maybe not so considerable thought, I decided that being drafted would not fit into my plans for myself. But being in school, I was deferred until the end of the school year. So this gave me an opportunity to look around for other openings rather than being drafted. And I recall interviewing all of the branches of the service that came to campus recruiting for officer material. And particularly with the Marine Corps, for what they call their squadron leaders. And the recruiter with whom I was talking said, "How old are you?" And if I recall, I would have been 24 my next birthday. And he said to me, "The cutoff date for this program is 24. And since you'll be 24 before you begin your training, you're too old to be eligible." And this was quite a blow, of course, to my ego. But I continued my search, and the Navy opened up their supply corps program to college students. And I made application and had not received any action on my application when I received my doctorate degree in June of 1941. I think it's 1941.
41.
And the draft board sent me notice to report for my physical examination upon completion of the school year. And I contacted the Norfolk Navy Base, the admiral in charge of the Supply Corps recruiting program. They requested deferment for induction of my draft board. And in June, I received my commission in the Supply Corps of the Navy as ensign.
This is June of 41.
June of 41. And later that summer, I was ordered to report for active duty for training for, I forget whether it was 60 or 90 days. But to make a long story short, before the active duty for training was completed, I had orders to report to the Navy Supply Corps School at Harvard for further training. And eventually, in October of 1945, I was discharged from the Navy.
Arnold, I want to go back for just a moment, even before your military career begins, and ask you about this stint at when you were teaching at West Virginia University. Obviously, you had that job before you received your PhD.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, they needed someone. This looked like an opportunity to get a little experience to earn a magnificent salary of, as I recall, $2,100 for 9 months. And it turned out that it was. And at the end of the year, they encouraged me to go back and finish my degree and were willing to place me on leave of absence for one, after 1 year of service. So that all the time I was in the Navy, I was on leave of absence from West Virginia University.
Where is it located?
Morgantown.
And it's still in operation today?
West Virginia University, yes.
It's still a big operation?
Well, I'm not sure how big an operation.
But I mean, it's a thriving school.
Oh, yes.
Football?
Yes.
And it had a strong program in what you were interested in teaching. What did you teach? Let me ask it that way.
I taught general economics, and actually taught a course in statistics.
How far away were you from the Charlottesville? I was wondering to what degree you were able to continue your PhD program there.
Well, the PhD program in Charlottesville made very little progress during the year that I was teaching at West Virginia.
I see. So you, in fact, what you did was almost like take a year of leave of absence from the PhD program.
That's right.
And then at the end of that year, of teaching, you then went back to Charlottesville and completed the program.
Yes.
But you still were able to hold on to that leave of absence, as you say, throughout the war.
Yes. I think that was a provision of the law that most positions had to be held while you were on active service.
So you could have come back, had you so desired, to that teaching position at Morgantown?
Yes, I never resigned that position until September or October 1945, when I had to make a decision whether to go back to West Virginia or accept some other type of employment.
How long were you at Harvard in the training program?
I forget whether that was for 4, 5, 6 months, something of that sort.
And then you went where?
I was assigned active duty. I was assigned as dispersing officer to a heavy cruiser, the USS Tuscaloosa.
In the Pacific or the Atlantic?
In the Atlantic. We were patrolling the area around Iceland, Nova Scotia, the North Atlantic against German U-boats and aircraft carriers.
As a dispersing officer, what were your responsibilities?
Well, basically to maintain the payrolls and pay the bills of the ship. And not such other duties as might be assigned.
Were you, did you continue with this throughout the war? Dispersing officer on this ship?
No, this was a tour of duty for about a year. Then I was detached and sent back to the States and assigned to a ship being commissioned in New York, being built and later to be commissioned. But they changed program emphasis, and that type of ship was put on low priority. So I was reassigned to an Acorn, which was assembling in Port Hueneme, California.
Where is that? Camp Franini?
Port Hueneme. Don't ask me to spell it.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to ask you to spell it, since I did not know how myself.
I think it's Y-O-E-N something.
Where is it near?
It's north of L.A., San Diego, south of San Francisco.
Someplace in that area. What'd you do there?
I was supply officer of an Acorn. The Acorns were units designed to manage airstrips in the Pacific.
How long were you at Fort Hueneme?
Hueneme. Only a couple of months.
And then?
Then we were put aboard a cargo ship and sent off down to the South Pacific, ending up at the Russell Islands.
You obviously did a lot of leisure traveling during the war, first in the Atlantic and now in the Pacific.
If you call it leisurely, Sam, we made one trip into Murmansk.
Oh.
One of the few U.S. ships, capital ships, I think, to go in at all, and certainly one of the few to go in and come out.
Were you involved in any military action?
Well, yes, in a sense, going into Murmansk, you know, it was military action, although there was no firing of guns. And later on, we were involved in the landings of Norfolk North Africa.
Were you still a single man?
At that time?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And so from what was your next episode, military episode?
Well, we were under orders to be transferred from the Russell Islands, where we were, quote, staging, unquote, to Biak, which is just off of New Guinea, where we would operate a land strip. But in the process of moving from the Russells to Biak, I fell aboard ship one day and fractured a hip, and the pelvis bone hip, and ended up in the hospital and being sent back to the States. So I saw very little action directly connected to the war in Mississippi.
Did you end, was the war ended and you were still in the States?
Yes, but I went from one assignment to another in the States.
You were discharged from service in 1945.
Yes.
Is that right? And then from 45 to 1948, you worked, as I have it here, as an economic analyst.
Yes.
In the U.S. Treasury Department. You were on the Office of the Technical Staff.
Right.
What was all of that about?
All of that was about analyzing economic conditions which existed, the probable impact of various decisions, government policies, so forth, on those economic conditions.
What rank were you when you were discharged from the military?
I was lieutenant commander.
Was this a cut in pay, the civilian job that you took, or?
No.
Good money?
Well, at the time, it wasn't bad. Compared to the present, it was very poor.
Was this a Washington, D.C. assignment?
Yes.
So, once again, you're still a bachelor?
Yes.
So you had to find a place for a bachelor to live?
Yes.
What was life like in Washington immediately after the war?
I would say it was very good.
Where were you living and where were you working?
I was living in D.C. I had rooms in a private home, and I was working at the Treasury Department building just adjacent to the White House.
So you were right kind of in the heart of all of the things that were going on.
Physically, yes.
Mr. Truman was the new president.
Right.
And, of course, all was right with the world. We had just won the war.
Yes, I think we could say that.
And I guess there was a great deal of enthusiasm everywhere in the United States, and maybe a lot of it in Washington, D.C. So you're there for 2 years. Almost 3 years, 45 to 48.
Yes.
And then comes the decision to come to the University of Florida. How did all of that happen?
Well, I guess there were several factors that were major. One was I enjoyed my year of teaching at West Virginia, and this was something I eventually wanted to do, to go back to. The second was that while I had a group of very good close friends in D.C., the traffic conditions were becoming, at that time, to me, almost unbearable. And I guess the deciding factor was going back in to Washington from the beach, whether we went to the beach at Norfolk or whether we went to the beaches in Delaware, Maryland, required as much time traveling or more time traveling to and from the beaches than you spend on the beach for a weekend, that this was not the quality of life that I envisioned for myself.
Were you a beach person? So that was a big factor?
Well, I use beach to indicate relative time for whatever, whether it was going to the mountains or not to the beach, it was the same problem.
So you were not dissatisfied with your work, but rather the living conditions in Washington at the time?
I think that was a major factor, although I would say that my work at times, I wondered whether it was really significant or not.
Could you have stayed on at the Treasury Department?
Yes.
Well, tell me about the coming to the University of Florida. How did all of that, you make up your mind that you want to lead an academic life?
Well, I talked to my major professor at Virginia, and he was constantly getting requests for names of people who were available for teaching positions. And he wanted to help me in any way he could to return to this type of position. And I think I told him that if he had some vacancies, notice of vacancies east of the Mississippi and south of the Potomac, that I would be glad to consider them. And one that turned up was at the University of Florida. And I had a request. I submitted my application and had a reply from Dean Matherly, who had family ties in Kentucky and who was going to be on a trip to Kentucky visiting relatives, and who wanted me to meet him while he was on that trip. We met, and the position he had originally wanted to consider me for, he had filled before, but it was director of the Bureau of Economic and Business Research, and he had made an offer to George Herb for that, to fill that position. And he said, when we parted in Kentucky, that he would like to have me on his faculty. But at the moment, he didn't have an opening. But if he had an opening, he would contact me. And I thought this was the nicest letdown I'd ever had as a job refusal.
Was anybody else looking for you at the moment?
No, I didn't have any other applications out at the moment.
Because the college enrollments were exploding then with the GI Bill of Rights.
That's right. And it was only a matter of weeks, I think, that before he made contact with me again and had a position that he wanted to offer me. And at the time, I think, whereas our earlier contact had been in the summer, I forget whether it was July or August, this was now September.
September of 48.
Of 48. And I was actually doing 2 weeks of training in the Navy supply system. And I had my Treasury Department job, which I had to give some time notice before quitting. And the University of Florida was already in session.
Those years we started in September.
Right. So that all of these things then put it into a tight time schedule if I was going to resign from the Treasury. Get finished with this 2 weeks duty for training in the Navy and report to the University of Florida, which we attempted and we did. So that I ended up 2 weeks late for class. And I think maybe had a rather successful first year of teaching at Florida.
What did Matherly offer you in the way of salary and rank?
He offered me assistant professor. And I forget exactly what salary he offered me, but it seemed to me like it was around $6,000 so a year.
What would your responsibilities be? What were you going to teach?
I was going to teach money and banking, corporate finance.
Were all these new programs at the University of Florida already? Were you getting involved in the planning for new things?
Well, not immediately at that time. I think the emphasis then was recruiting people to cover existing courses and expanding the existing program and not necessarily developing new programs.
Arnold, did you ever teach in the University College?
No.
You did not ever teach the basic American institutions course. There were people from various colleges on campus.
That's right, and several of my colleagues in the College of Business did teach those American institutions courses.
Atwood, I think, was one. No, Atwood was in geography. But there were some.
I think Kim Donovan
taught.
And I'm not sure what John McFerrin taught some of those courses.
I don't know, but he did or not. How did you get to Gainesville?
I drove a car.
You use the pronoun we. Is there a change in your status by 1948 when you come to Gainesville?
No.
So you're still coming as a single person.
Still coming as a single
person. So it's not a we, it's an I, yeah.
It's an I so far as that is concerned.
All right, you come to Gainesville. Where'd you live?
Well, initially, I checked into the White House Hotel. But I found a room and bath and a private home that belonged to Gerald and Lydia Stout. And I lived there for several weeks and found an apartment in the Garden Apartments on Northeast 9th Street, I believe. And lived there until, well, for the school year, and another faculty member and myself located a house nearer to the campus on Northwest 5th Avenue. And we lived there a year. And at the end of that time, I was being married in September. And we bought a home that had been built by Forrester Professor.
Geltz.
No. The big one.
I don't remember. Where was it located?
North of what was Columbia Street at the time, later became Northwest 7th Avenue.
Near 17th.
Near 17th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The one the forest is named for, Frank, Sam.
Cary?
No. Maybe the forest been named for him.
I don't know. But it'll come to us. Who did you share the house with the year that you had the rented house?
Part of the year with Scott Hagelman. And the other part of the year with the history professor.
Ashby Hammond?
Ashby Hammond.
Our mutual friend, Ashby.
Right.
Where were your classes? Matherly Hall was not yet constructed, or was it?
No. My classes were in Building I and later on some in Building G. I think some in Peabody.
And the Building I and the Building G were all of the temporary buildings that had been brought in for military installations,
right.
And the campus was peppered with these, quote, temporaries,
right.
Which lasted a long time.
My office was in another temporary, which was Building D.
Is that the one that was adjacent to Anderson Hall?
No, this is the one that was where the school of architecture partly is now, and where they had the cattle pens.
Wasn't that Grove Hall?
Yeah.
They called it Grove Hall.
I think that was Grove Hall.
I had an office there too for a short while, and I remember Ralph Turlington and Jim Richardson shared an office in that building.
Yeah.
And then they turned it, or had been a women's dormitory, or they were turning it into a, I think it had been a women's dormitory before they gave it to us.
I think that's probably right. I don't think they turned it back into a dormitory after.
The sinkhole was right out in front of it.
Right.
And the cattle barns were in the back.
Right.
Dairy barns, I think we called them at the time.
They were really breeding barns, right?
That's right, yeah. They later turned those over to the Florida Players, and they converted them into places, rehearsal halls for their dramatic productions on campus. How many hours did you teach in those early pioneer days?
I think we taught as many as 15.
And I think there were classes on Saturday, if you will recall.
There were. And at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And earlier than that, perhaps in the summer, we all had 9 months contract.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues with tape A, side two.
I think we really had firm department in the college at that time. With the exception of accounting and I think real estate.
Did you deal then directly with Walter Matherly, the dean?
Yes, but it seems to me that to some extent he had delegated certain responsibilities to others and John McFerrin. was either my mentor or I tended to go through him.
You know, I was his student assistant.
You were.
I was the one who typed Caldwell and Company that went off to the publisher. He had an office in what is now Flint Hall, down at the west end of it on the second floor.
When I came, he was in Peabody.
They moved him out of there the next year, or perhaps maybe no. Because that was earlier than that. I worked for him earlier than that. He was still in Flint Hall then. Now, tell me about you getting married. Then I'm going to get back to your academic world.
What is it you'd like to know?
I would like to know who you married and when.
I married Mary Lippitt, who was an instructor in physical education.
How'd you spell Mary's last name?
L-I-P-P-I-T-T.
When did you marry?
In September of 1950, I believe.
And two children came from this marriage.
Right.
Their names?
Mary Catherine and Charles Arnold Jr.
Tell me about Mary Catherine. Just get some bio information. Her name is what now?
Her name is now Hoffman. She lives in Richmond. And is a CPA and has two boys, Michael 7 and Brian 4.
And Charles?
Charles is an aviator. He flies for the Thomas H. Lee Company.
Thomas H. Leach?
H. Lee, L-E-E.
Okay.
Out of Boston. And he's a chief pilot. They have 7 or 8 pilots and I think 2 airplanes.
And he's married?
He's married, has a stepdaughter, and is expecting another addition to the family.
All right, let's go back to your academic career now. When you came, kind of describe, as you remember it, the status of the college. And the faculty, large, small?
Well, I guess the college compared to the present and to the rest of the university would have considered to have been small in relation to the total, but growing rapidly. The faculty we thought was pretty good. The departmental structure was rather loose. I'm not sure just what I could say about it.
Was this a college that already had a graduate program?
Yeah.
That was the senior faculty. Of course, many of those dated back into the 1930s, didn't they?
Right.
People like Moby Dick Anderson.
Moby Dick Anderson, Truman. Or transportation.
Economics.
John Eldridge. Bates had just left in accounting, so the senior position in accounting was open. A man by the name of Chase was heading up real estate. John McFerrin was a relatively young senior member of the faculty, I guess. He'd been here before the war and had returned. Was, I guess, considered the senior man in finance.
Richardson was on the faculty, James Richardson. Of course, he was not, he was after the war.
He was after the war. He was, I'm not sure whether Jim's title was instructor or whether he was simply a graduate student when I first came here.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me again what you taught when you first came.
I taught money and banking and corporate finance.
Mm-hmm. Now you began to move up pretty quickly. You came here as an assistant professor of finance in 48.
Right.
And you occupied that position for 2 years and then became an associate professor in 1950.
Yes.
And that for 3 years to 1953.
I guess that's right.
And during that period, there was an interval when they called you back into service, didn't they?
Yes.
The Korean conflict.
Right.
Was that pretty traumatic?
Well, it was. For one thing, it was unexpected. For another thing, I was just beginning to feel pretty well established in my profession. And for another thing, we were expecting Kathy to be born.
So this was a bolt out of the blue then?
It was. I received a call from the personnel office of the Navy, indicating that I was being called to active duty. They were not able to give me the required length of notice as to when, considering the date and when they expected me to report. So they were making the notice by telephone call rather than by routine correspondence. And when I got the first call, it was indication indicated that I was going to be assigned to teach at the Navy Supply Corps School at New Jersey. The name of the town's me at the moment. But the commanding officer of the Navy Supply Corps School said that he only wanted instructors who were returning from sea duty on his staff, and that was not acceptable. So I received a notice of change in duty and that I was to report to the Commandant Navy Supply Corps, Navy, U.S. Naval Academy, Annapolis, to teach as opposed to the Supply Corps School in New Jersey. And this was really a godsend since the New Jersey location was one of the least preferred in the entire Navy.
But the Naval Academy was a nice operation.
Well, it was a plum.
Were you able to take the family?
Oh, yes.
Well, you must have stayed in the reserves then, Arnold, when you were discharged, and that's the reason they're calling you back
right.
In 1951. How long did that stint last?
2 years.
So you came back to the University of Florida in 1953 then.
Right.
And you come back and almost immediately then are promoted to professor of finance.
Yeah.
So you move up pretty quickly then from 48 to 53. You go through all of the ranks.
Yeah.
You must have been considered one of their stars.
I don't know.
Well, the record proves it. Now, the college is expanding?
Yes, becoming departmentalized. We have a Department of Economics, Department of Finance, Department of Real Estate, and Department of Accounting.
And you become chairman of the Department of Finance and Insurance in 1958 is the information that I have here. You're a professor of finance through 57. Is that wrong?
No, so far as I know, those dates are accurate.
Okay, they're from your vita.
We had grown considerably in faculty and students. Dean Matherly died, I think, in 53.
And he was succeeded by whom?
Don Hart.
Donald Hart.
And Don started a review of faculty and organization in the college. And out of that came a report recommending the creation of the Department of Marketing, the Department of Management, and the Department of Finance and Insurance. And John McFerrin was John was the first chairman of the Department of Finance and Insurance.
And then you succeeded him?
No. Vic Sweeney succeeded him. John was appointed by Hart as Director of Graduate Studies. And a man by the name of Vic Sweeney, who taught insurance, was made chairman of the department. And then other faculty, of course, signed to other departments and they had their chairman.
Is this when James Butterworth came aboard as chairman of marketing?
Yes.
And who was chairman of management?
Sam, I'm not sure I can tell you that.
Well, we can go back into the early catalogs on that. That's an easy one to get. So, 57, 58, the college, under the leadership of Don Hart, goes through a major reorganization?
Yes.
And obviously expansion?
Yes.
That has been the story of the College of Business since the end of World War II, continuing expansion in terms of additional courses, new programs, and expanding student enrollment.
Right.
And obviously you became press for space.
Right.
And a new building then was constructed?
Yes, the building was constructed while Matherly was still dean. And I think completed, and he actually moved into the dean's office, but died not too long after the...
And that's when the decision was made to name it for Walter Matherly.
Right.
And you moved then your offices into that building?
Yes.
Now, you taught, and you also now become an administrator, the chairman of a department.
Well, not immediately.
In 58, you become the chair.
Yeah.
Did you welcome taking on the administrative responsibilities?
Well, I guess I was pleased to be offered the position. I'm not sure that I made any effort to obtain the position, but I think, as a matter of fact, I was not even in residence when the decision was made to name me chairman of the department.
were other members of your faculty, your department at the time?
Well, the senior member of the faculty would have been John McFerrin.
Wasn't he moving off the scene about now?
Well, he was still a very influential member of the faculty and also a member of the department. That was John Dietz.
Dietz?
Dietz.
D-E-I-T-Z?
Yes. Who was retired from the investment banking business, who had joined the faculty several years before and taught the advanced courses in investments.
John Eldridge, of course, was...
He was economics.
He was one of the really colorful people on the campus.
Yes.
A wonderful guy. He and I were good friends.
Yes.
And I remember he was kind of the curmudgeon of the campus.
That's right.
Writing letters to the alligator and lambasting the construction of Taggart Hall, which he called the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm. And we had Jim Richardson on the faculty.
Turlington did not teach in your department?
Turlington was gone.
He's already gone into the insurance business.
Right. And I'm not sure at the time that Ralph taught and left that the finance insurance department had become well organized. It did not exist in name.
Mm-hmm.
We had, prior to the breakup of the departments under Hart, we had an organization that consisted of the Department of Economics, the Department of Business Organization and Operations, the Department of Real Estate, and the Department of Accounting. So that this whole BO&O department, or the BOO department, was split into three individual departments. And John McFerrin was the chairman of the BO&O department, and then of the finance department. And he was succeeded by Dick Sweeney, who was a professor of insurance, as chairman of the finance and insurance department.
What about accounting now? Who was chair of that?
Lanham was chairman of accounting.
Wasn't his name James Lanham?
I think so.
I think it was. And then he was succeeded by Willard Stone?
Yes.
That obviously had to be an expanding department with the growth of the state and the pressures to graduate more people in accounting.
It was a growing department. And I think the reason that Lanham left, or one of the reasons, was that he was not designated as dean when Matherly died.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something of a struggle between Uchtler, who had been Matherly's associate dean, Lanham, and McFerrin, for the deanships, for the dean's position. And Lanham and McFerrin sort of closed it off for either one, or for each other, I guess.
So Hart was brought in as kind of a compromise then?
Yes, and as I understand the chain of events, he was brought in sort of as the last viable alternative, that Wrights was president, or had become president.
J. Hillis Miller dies in November of 1953, and John Allen was the acting president until Wrights comes aboard in 55.
Right. And for a period of time there, we'd been operating with an acting president, an acting dean, and I'm not sure what other acting in the hierarchy of things.
You think, did you say that McFerrin was the acting dean?
No, Uechtler was acting.
Uechtler. Is Uechtler still living?
No.
So all three of these men are gone now. Is Lanham up?
I'm not sure about Lanham.
I don't know where he went when he left here.
I'm not sure that I could tell you where he went. Mm-hmm. But the story goes that Wrights asked George
Herbst?
No. An assistant that was president of New College.
Bowman. George Bowman.
Who was in the business office of the university at the time. And was going around visiting all universities for the accrediting agencies. If he hadn't run across some young, aspiring, energetic deans that he could recommend for the College of Business. And George said he'd just been to University of Idaho.
That's where Hart was?
Yeah. And George said yes, that he run across this young man that he thought would be just the person that Wrights would like. So they brought him in for interviews, and he was offered the job.
I wondered how Hart got here. You're telling me a story I hadn't heard before.
You hadn't heard that story?
I had not heard about George Bowman's involvement in Hart's becoming the dean of the College of Business. I knew George Bowman was involved in lots of things. Lots of things.
I think if you want to verify that, you can try Clem Donovan.
Well, George Bowman is also available. He lives here in Gainesville now.
He may deny that he had anything to do with it.
I know. Well, I'm going to just go on the basis of what you're saying and accept it as historical accuracy. So, the question I was raising was about growth and development. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I wanted to know about accounting because we're going to start building up toward the school itself. To what degree did you relate in terms of your own finance and insurance programs to that department?
We had, I would say, a very cordial relationship. I didn't feel we had any problems with respect to turf, that our areas were pretty well defined. There was some overlapping between some accounting courses and some finance courses, but not serious, not to the extent that we had battles and the faculty meetings on curriculum design, construction, over them.
Now, when a student came here to study accounting, the student also had to take courses in your department?
Oh, yes. All students all receiving degrees from the college had to have at least two finance courses. One would be what we call money and banking, that was subject of debate as to whether it was economics or finance. And at one time, at least, we cross-listed it as either, so that you could take the same FI course that you took economics course, and it would be the same instructor, the same textbook. So you could fill that requirement either through economics or finance.
I know the college had a graduate program. Did you have a graduate program in finance and insurance?
Only as it was a part of the college graduate program.
So that students did not come in and
Oh, yes. They had their concentration in finance.
You know, one of the things I did not ask you earlier, and I want to get it on the record, this goes way back. You remember your dissertation title? What did you do your dissertation on way back in the
day? I did it on state. Not sure I can give you the exact title at the moment.
Well, you'll fill that in also.
On state taxes, taxation of oleomargarine, an analysis of taxation for non-fiscal purposes.
That certainly does not sound like a very sexy title to me, an exciting project.
Well, at the time, Sam, oleomargarine was not very well accepted.
And now, when they figure out it helps your cholesterol, it's much more respectable.
Well, it became much more respectable when the laws prohibiting the addition of color to oleo.
Oh, I remember that white glob that used to sell on the plate.
The sales increased tremendously.
It began to look like butter.
Right. And
you had that little powder you mixed in and to
that's
it.
That's right.
Colored it up.
That's right. And I think the oleo lobby used my data that I compiled to get a lot of these state laws repealed.
When you become part of the academic world here in Gainesville at the University of Florida in the 1950s, and in your college, was there much push, much urgency for faculty to do research?
Yes.
Publish and perish concept?
Yes, but I think it was not enforced like it has become in recent years.
Now, was this true of Matherly, or did that come in with Don Hart? Matherly was not himself a great research scholar.
No, and I think under Matherly there was more lip service than actual fact insofar as the type of research that was required. And I'm not sure how much output had to be demonstrated in order for the requirement to be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. What was your involvement as a research scholar?
I'm afraid not as much as it should have been.
But you began writing and publishing in the 50s?
Yes, and I'm not sure that what I wrote and published would be considered original research, as much as reinterpretation and
But you were doing the requisite amount in terms of your colleagues at the time.
Yeah.
And your programs then, once again, the departments are all expanding in terms of students. Where were the students coming from in the 50s and 60s here at the university, in the College of Business?
Of course, they were primarily from within the state. And within the state, I would say the large residential, rapidly growing residential areas of the lower East Coast.
The Miami area.
Yes, and Jacksonville. And probably the Tampa, St. Petersburg area.
Were you already beginning to turn out some stars? People who were moving up in the corporate ranks or wherever?
I think a few.
Now that they become much more numerous later on.
Yes.
What was the reputation of the college and your particular departments back in those earlier years?
Well, I think the college had a pretty good reputation around the state, but it was due to a considerable extent to Dean Mather's interest in promotion, I guess we'd say politics, and activity in such things as the State Chamber of Commerce. I've often thought that Dean Mather did an excellent job of selling himself, and to some extent having this applied to the college, but that there was nothing lasting that would keep the college going. But he was not out waving the flag.
He was always hoping to become a college president, too.
Yeah, and at one time, I understand, there was considerable discussion of him as a viable candidate for governor.
There was. It never really got off base at all, but there was discussion of that, and he did not discourage that at all.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, he would have liked that to have happened.
And that he was rather serious been the running for president of FSU at one time.
Well, he had a charismatic personality, and he spoke well, and he certainly looked the part of college president, if there is such an image. But he did promote that, of course, very well. Now, when Hart comes in, he's much more of an academic scholar, isn't he?
Yes, but Hart never really published, did much in the way of original research.
Were the...
He did write a textbook in basic management, I guess.
When did the College of Business begin to be compared favorably with schools like Chapel Hill and Duke and Virginia and so on?
I would say not until well into Lancelotti's tenure as dean.
So that this was still pretty much, to use a trite phrase, a provincial school on to the early 1970s anyway.
Yeah.
It ranked well within the state, but not very well, comparatively speaking, with other major universities in the South, and had little national status.
Well, if other major universities in the South, you mean Virginia, Chapel Hill.
Duke.
Vanderbilt. I think that's true.
But how about with the University of Alabama, the University of Georgia?
Well, I think Florida ranked well with Alabama, Georgia, well, I shouldn't say Georgia Tech, because they're not noted as a business school. Mm-hmm. Certainly the Mississippi schools, the Louisiana schools, Kentucky schools.
Was your college and your department getting a pretty fair slice of the financial pie that came to the university from the legislature?
I would say we did fairly well under Matherly. We did not fare so well under Hart.
Why not?
I don't think Don was a very aggressive promoter of the College of Business. And I think we did much better under Lancelotti.
Now, Hart succeeded by Lancelotti?
Yes.
So what you had in the post-war period then was Matherly, Hart, Lancelotti, Merton, and now Kraft.
Right.
So there have been five deans in that period, really, of 40-plus, almost 50 years.
Yes.
Actually, longer than that, because Matherly was the first dean. So you've had five deans over the period of the history of the college.
Yes, and I guess the college was organized in late 20s, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. I want to jump ahead here and ask you, I noticed that there has been, I guess, some sort of a reorganization, because in 1972, real estate has been added to your department.
Mm-hmm.
What brought that about?
That was brought about by decree.
I mean, any special reason? I thought that was a separate department under Al Ring.
It was. And Al Ring and Lancelotti had some personality problems, I guess. But
two volatile characters.
Be the way to state it, Sam.
I know both of them.
And the dean let it be known to Al that the real estate department was had too few faculty and too few students to make it a viable separate department, and that he was going to merge it into the Department of Finance and Insurance. And he reached this decision. I'm not sure whether he conferred with whom he conferred, but somewhere along the way he mentioned it to John McFerrin. And John was then associate dean, or whether he had that title or not, he was serving as Lancelotti's chief advisor. And John wanted to know if he had checked it with the chairman of the Department of Finance and Insurance.
One Arnold Matthews.
Right. And Lancelotti said no. John said, well, don't you think you ought to let him in on it before you? But somewhere along the way he discussed it, and I indicated that I was willing to add this to my other chores. And in the process of this merger taking place, Al retired. But I think if rumors are at all accurate, after considerable effort to move the real estate program into the College of Agriculture, or even to a separate school, I'm not sure about the
which service. He might endow.
Well, which he might. Whether he made any actual overtures to South Florida or not, I don't know. But he retired before the merger took place. So he was never really a member of the Department of Finance and Insurance.
Alfred Ring is another one of the colorful characters in the history of the University of Florida.
He is.
Still plays tennis, you know, every single day.
Yeah.
Well up into his 80s. And I guess enjoys life. You got along well with Al?
With Al Ring? I thought I always got along well with Al, but we haven't seen each other much since the merger took place.
Well, he's very visible. Going to see him, he's on his bike over to the post office every day. So Al, then, I'd never heard about this business of Ring wanting it to become part of the College of Agriculture. I'd always heard the long-standing argument that economics belong in the College of Business, or should it not be shifted to the College of Arts and Sciences?
And, of course, on that basis, I guess there still are members of the Department of Economics who are members of the Faculty of College of Arts and Sciences.
Woodruff.
Is he the only one now?
That's the only one I know of, yeah, William Woodruff. Who shifted, you remember, back and forth.
Now, don't they still give an economics major in arts and sciences?
I think so, yeah. I believe that's true, but I don't really know.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Now, you become a dean yourself in 1976. So, first, I mean, you make the first mistake by becoming a chairman, and then you're seduced further to become an associate dean in 76. Who wooed you into that? McFerrin?
No, the dean appointed a faculty committee to make recommendations for an associate dean. And I forget who the members of the committee were, except that Gene Brigham was a member. And there were two others, but...
Brigham was from here?
Yes. Brigham came here in the early 70s as graduate research professor.
Now, you earlier had a Bingham in, but yes, he's retired by now?
Bingham.
Tom Bingham, wasn't it? He was just a professor. Truman. I know we're not... Truman Bingham.
But he died back in the...
50s?
50s or 60s.
I remembered. I wasn't getting him mixed up.
He was the one I was trying to think of as a senior professor.
Okay.
When I first came here.
Okay. All right.
And as a matter of fact, I think he directed the graduate program at the time that I first came on the faculty.
Now, when you take over as associate dean in 1976, you also become the director of graduate studies?
Yes.
So there's a joint responsibility.
Yes.
You give up the chairmanship of the department.
Yes.
Who succeeds you there?
Arnold Higginstead, I think.
What were your responsibilities then as associate dean?
Doing whatever the dean told me to do.
Well, you were more than just a gopher.
Sometimes I wonder, Sam.
But what, did you have any specific responsibilities?
I was responsible for the budget of the college, for seeing that the departments followed this procedures, and general oversight of the graduate curriculum.
Was Lancelotti the kind of person that delegated?
Yes, but also closely supervised.
Mm-hmm. He wanted to know what was going on.
And often determined what was going on.
How How successful would you say you were as an administrator, Arnold?
I don't think I was very good.
You didn't like it?
Not particularly.
But you got along well with people. You had the kind of personality that enabled people to trust you and rely on you.
I think I got along because I was not too assertive. And I tried to treat everyone equally. And tried to keep out of internal squabbles as much as possible.
Who were your closest colleagues, your real friends?
Well, I guess Sam, over the years, the closest colleagues would have been the people in the department. But in later years, John McFerrin, John McFerrin really from the time I first came here on, I think I have to give him credit for a lot of the success I had, if I've had success. Clem Donovan I have always considered to be a friend, and to some extent an ally.
You retired in 1982?
Yeah.
Was it because of illness, or were you just tired and burnt out?
Well, no, it was not because of illness. When I became associate dean, the university had a policy that administrators retired from administration at 65. I think that's right.
That's right.
So that,
and faculty at 70.
In 81, I became 65. So I tendered my resignation. And as the date for retirement approached, the dean committee had not made its recommendation, and he was worrying to me one day is when I quit, who was going to take over my duties. And I said, well, Bob, if you would like, I can serve on for another year, provided the 65 age limit is not going to be a factor. And he said, all right, I'll see what I can work out with Bob Bryan. And the decision was made for me to carry on as associate dean. For one more year. But in the process, the committee made a recommendation that John Kraft be associate dean.
Was John Kraft already on the faculty?
Yes. And
end of tape A, side two. The interview continues with tape B, side one.
Okay, you said that I asked you if John Kraft was already on the faculty because you said that the faculty had voted to have him brought in as associate dean.
That was a recommendation of the search committee.
Okay.
And
did that interfere then with that 1 year that Lancelotti was working out with for you?
In a sense, but there were two major projects process in the college. One was the construction of the general business building, and the other was It's evaluation by the Southern Association of Colleges and Universities. And I had been active in both of these projects. So the decision was made that I would continue on for the evaluation of the visiting committee and also for the move from other buildings into the new building. And hence, when these projects were finished, I retired, I think in April of 1982, instead of going on through until June.
Mm-hmm. Were you drawn into the increasing activity of fundraising in the 1960s and 1970s? Was that ever a role that you played in the college?
Not especially.
Lancelotti really played the major role there, didn't he?
Yes, and about the only involvement I ever got into that was in setting up meetings with some alumni around the state and helping organize the meeting and getting the invitations sent out and list of people who might be potential donors.
One of the areas I wanted to ask you about had to do with this Florida School of Banking. I guess that was under the auspices of the Florida Banking Association.
Yeah.
What was it, and what role did you play?
Well, most of the state banking associations, a lot of them had established a school of banking, which was to upgrade employees in some basic economic and finance courses, and also in some of the major areas of occupation within the banking industry. And a delegation from the Florida Bankers Association came to me as chairman of the finance department one year and wanted to know if we would be interested in helping the association set up a state school like those in Tennessee, seems like Georgia had one, and several of the other states. And I told him we would be interested in helping them to do this. And they let it be known that some members of our faculty would not be acceptable for their purpose, but that indicated they would like me to do this, which the dean thought was very appropriate. And I guess this was hard at the time. Might have been Lancelotti. I think it was hard that it was given we set up the school.
I'm curious as to why they felt that certain members were not qualified.
Did I say qualified or did I say acceptable?
Acceptable is what you said.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question for you.
All right. Okay, we'll just drop that question then.
And I spent about a year working with the committee of bankers, the chairman of which was Rod Porter, over in Jacksonville, who at that time was with Atlantic Bank. And we came up with a curriculum, a course of study extending over 3 summers, 1 week each summer, with homework to be done between school sessions and papers turned in on this homework. And it became very popular with the bank at the beginning. so that we started off with an enrollment limit to 60 each summer. It was soon clear we had to extend this. We went to 120, and I think eventually they got as high as 200, 250 and enrolled. It's since the interstate merges and the large chain systems, it's lost some of its popularity, but it's still running.
You were the director of it for 10 years?
Educational director.
So you formulated the curriculum and...
Right. And the bankers themselves did the administrative work. They did all of the typing, all of the printing.
Where were the faculty drawn from? This campus was one place.
This campus, some other academic programs. I think we have pretty much always had one representative from the faculty at FSU. And from the banking industry itself, or the more technical banking sector.
But the students get a certificate? Or
a certificate.
Was this applicable for college degrees?
No.
So these were people really, doing technical work, becoming one in the bank, tellers?
These were senior, I don't want to say clerical, but supervisory, I guess, personnel. And junior officer type in the bank, loan officers, investment banking officers.
Second level?
Yes.
Directors and managers?
Mm-hmm.
Arnold, I want to get into the area now of accounting, which I understand was not yours immediately, but obviously you were involved in it, and particularly after you become the associate dean. Why do you think that they moved in the direction of setting up a separate school of accounting? They didn't set up separate schools for the other areas of activity in the college.
I'm not really asking
about the thinking behind this.
I'm not sure I can answer to your satisfaction. And it would be mostly surmise, I guess. But I think they have reached a point where there was demand by the accounting firms for graduates who had a stronger base in accounting than the four-year graduates they were getting. And the movement towards the so-called freestanding schools of accounting and the expansion of the accounting education program from 4 years to 5 years degree requirement sort of proceeded hand in hand. And this also would then tend to bring them into conflict with the American Association of Collegiate Schools of Business and pressure for a broader curriculum requirement as opposed to a more concentrated accounting-oriented curricular requirement, which the School of Accounting would seem to accommodate. You following?
I follow along. I was going to ask you, is one of the reasons for the pressure brought by these firms is because accounting now by the 1960s has become much more technical, that they felt that they couldn't get what they needed under the more traditional programs, that they needed more time, more courses, more special areas?
I'm not sure, Sam, I would use the term technical, although...
Advanced?
Complicated.
Complicated.
Technical sort of implies this is something you process, and I think it's a little more than that. And the regulatory agencies have become such a factor to be considered in accounting procedures that it had loaned itself to, I guess, more studies, whether it's deeper or broader, I'm not sure. Probably a little bit of both.
Did you discern hostility or opposition within the faculty for accounting to become a freestanding operation?
I think that was, I don't know if I discerned hostility. I think there was, at least at the beginning, a
jealousy?
No, not jealousy, but concern that they were out to take more and more of accounting courses and less of economic and other discipline courses.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a freestanding school, the faculty on a school of accounting would not be accountable to the College of Business. Is that a fair statement or question?
I think that's a fair objective. That
that have their own independent budget, could make their own decisions over curriculum.
Yes. But I'm not sure how, as the relationship between the School of Accounting and the College of Business Yale was worked out, to what extent they have complete autonomy within their curriculum.
Well, when the School of Accounting becomes a fact, obviously a lot of compromises must have been worked out, because the School of Accounting never became a freestanding operation at the University of Florida.
Well, I think if my memory is correct, that under the Constitution of the University of Florida, the School of Accounting could not award degrees, could it?
No, it could not.
And
because I guess the Board of Regents could have changed that.
No one seemed to have been willing to take it to the Board of Regents to have it changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason for that was that there were other areas on campus that were watching rather carefully or closely to see if accounting did achieve these objectives, because they wanted to do the same.
So to curtail that kind of explosive action throughout the university, they held accounting to a situation within the college.
Yeah. I think this was one of the major factors.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, they were trying to accommodate the accounting profession and within this university, and the accounting profession without the university, to enable them to raise the funds they needed to expand the program as they wanted to expand it.
What role did you play, if any, before you became associate dean in establishing the School of Accounting?
Not any.
Was your advice sought?
Well, I remember talking to members of the faculty and to John Simmons and other members of the accounting department, but I would say they were seeking my advice on how to proceed or whether to proceed or not.
Were you used by the college as a peacemaker?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Was there a need for that kind of thing?
I was going to say, I don't know if there was a need for a peacemaker. That it proceeded rather slowly, in a sense, over a rather long period of time.
As you look back on it, was Lancelotti a positive or a negative factor in its development?
Well, I think if you're looking at the finished product, that Lancelotti was a positive factor in its development. Now, whether or not Lancelotti was positive in the sense that he took the initiative to instigate this, I don't know.
He may not have been very enthusiastic about losing control of accounting if it was to become a freestanding operation.
But I don't think, given the structure that they finally worked out, where the Dean of the College of Business is also Dean of the School of Accounting, that he lost much personal control.
I think that was threatened, though, for a while.
I'm sure that it may have been. But I don't think it tended to nearly become a reality.
Were you on the search committees for any of the faculty or administrators that were brought into the school?
No.
What about after you became associate dean? Was the school in any way under your jurisdiction and supervision?
No. There was a continuing struggle, I guess would be the right term to describe it, between Lancelotti and John Simmons and later Schaefer, that the chairman, the director of the school that succeeded John Simmons?
Schaefer.
Yeah.
Is he still around?
So far as I know. I may have the name a little bit mixed up.
I don't know. It's not ringing a bell with me at all.
It wouldn't be any trouble to find out.
Oh, no, easily found out.
But one thing that Lancelotti tried to do was have the accounting budget funneled through the office of the associate dean.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been you.
Yeah. And Simmons and his successor resisted this, so that I did not usually see what they had recommended on copies of their budget. I don't know how that has been resolved in more recent years.
I gather that the relationship between Simmons and Lancelotti was not always the smoothest,
no.
Or else Simmons would not have given up the directorship and moved into this position with the chair.
I think that's probably right. And the budget was one of those things. I don't think appointments to the faculty of the School of Accounting and recommendations for promotion and salary adjustments did not go through the associate dean. as they do in other departments.
Did you always have good warm relationships with Lancelotti?
I never had a run-in with Lancelotti.
Yeah, but that's not really what I'm asking.
What are you asking?
I'm asking if it was a warm, close working relationship.
I'm not sure I can know how to interpret the term warm. We worked together rather closely. And obviously there's a personal relationship there. But I don't think Lancelot is the person you get real close to. Maybe I'm not either. But I would say we had a cordial working relationship.
No problems then?
No.
I know he has been kind of a controversial personality on the campus. Not controversial in a negative way, but maybe colorful, volatile, however you want to call it.
That's right.
And I can see how that might upset or some people.
Well,
I know he's fixed in his ways.
I know there was a lot of discussion among some of the people in the college, particularly the department chairman, during Don Hart's tenure, that what we needed was a forceful dean who would go over to Target Hall and pound the table
and tell Bob Bryant. Yeah.
But he didn't. Whereas Lancelotti did. And I think, regardless of how you view him as an individual, you would have to agree that he achieved results.
Yes, certainly in terms of salary and other money benefits for the college.
And not only for the college, I think Lancelotti deserves a lot of credit for some of the general fund increase in fundraising for the university.
Oh, sure. Do you think that this was a wise decision to set up a school of accounting as you look back on it now?
Well, to the extent that it has helped, I guess, raise funds, although for the most part, basically for the school itself, that this has to have had some rub off for funds coming into the college and into the rest of the university. And has probably given other administrators incentives to undertake some of the things they may not have undertaken otherwise.
You don't want to judge, however, the success of the school just on the basis of its ability to raise funds, do you?
Well, to the extent that this helps increase personnel and programs, I think it has a positive.
Or do you think we're turning out a better qualified student as a result of the kind of curriculum that the school has as compared with the Department of Accounting?
To the extent that the curriculum of the School of Accounting has not been permitted to become too narrow, as remain broad-based in terms of other disciplines as well as accounting. I think there's been some improvement.
You know, Arnold.
I have very little basis on which to judge the finished product, Sam.
Arnold, I have, as you know, have been a member of the College of Arts and Sciences teaching in the History Department. And one of the things that we've always thought over the years, no formal discussion on the thing, is that the students who go through the College of Business do not come out as humanists, that they have been so loaded down with courses in economics and finance and insurance and whatever, that they don't know that what the rest of the world is like, and that they, as a result, really don't adjust themselves. How do you feel about something like that?
Well, I think the accusation is probably true that students who graduate from business administration in general do not have the humanitarian courses, the sociological courses that gives them the base they really should have for leadership in the business world. But short of extending the time required for degrees, I'm not sure how you're going to accomplish.
Were these matters that were discussed by the faculty at the time that you were active?
From time to time, as major curriculum revisions occur, they, what, every 10 years? Is that your experience?
Yes. I know I had an interview with the first dean of the College of Medicine, and he said that when he came here in the 1950s, he was insistent that the medical students take regular courses in the in history, in English, in a language, and so on, although that has pretty much disappeared from their curriculum too. I wonder if there was the same sort of enthusiasm or emphasis or drive as far as your college was concerned.
To increase the human?
Well, to enable the students to have enough electives so that they could take a course in U.S. history or a course in English literature or a drama course or a music course or whatever.
It's been an objective that has been voiced from the time I first entered college, I guess, and particularly with relationship to business, colleges of business, and I assume agriculture and other...
And engineering.
And engineering. But while we provide for certain free electives, all too frequently the student takes those electives in the discipline that he's concentrating in and not in the disciplines that they were set up to provide for.
One of the purposes of the General College, later the University College, when it was set up in the 1930s, was to provide that kind of a basic education. And a number of the colleges on the campus, right from the very beginning, engineering, for instance, was one, and agriculture to a degree. Also, I don't know about business, were opposed to that because they said you're taking away the first 2 years and the student really needs to, instead of taking English, he needs to be taking accounting.
Well, I'm sure that there were those in the faculty in the College of Business were on both sides. Some would have supported the University College concept because of its broadening influence, and others would have wanted more time for areas within the college. In net, but whether we've gained much or not, I don't know.
Well, the University College goes out of existence at the end of the 1970s. Sidman is brought in as the new dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. You're an associate dean in the College of Business at the time. Was this a matter of concern to you, to your colleagues, to other administrators in your college?
If it was a concern, Sam, I don't remember discussing it very much with anyone.
It was not a matter then where the faculty talked about it at a faculty meeting?
No. And one of the trends, and I'm not sure whether it has continued since I retired, was of some concern, was the extent to which over the years the faculty seemed to become less and less concerned with the overall university curriculum.
In other words, this is our area, our turf, and we want to protect it.
Well, I'm not sure how much of that is involved. How much does let someone else worry about the curriculum requirements?
Mm-hmm.
I'll do my thing and do my research. And that's the way it is.
Now, the college obviously ranks up not only regionally but nationally now, doesn't it?
Yes.
Can you say that with enthusiasm, or is that just...
Well, I think I can say it with enthusiasm. I think to some extent in doing this, we have decreased its accessibility of the college for a large number of average students. And the success of your graduates, of course, depends on the quality of the input you have. The curriculum instruction, inspiration they get while they're here, and then the availability of positions once they graduate. And in struggling to have faculty recognition that outside of the college that is necessary in order to gain the evaluations of excellence in program or in the top 25 or the top 15 or whatever, means concentrating on publication and less on teaching. I'm not sure just how successful this is going to be for the college in the long run.
Arnold, when did the MBA program become part of the college curriculum?
Sam, I think it was... I couldn't really answer that.
Was that part of your... during your watch? During the time that you were still on the faculty?
Oh, yeah. The MBA program goes way back.
Oh, does it?
Mm-hmm. I was trying to think whether it was before I came or whether it was after I got here. And somehow, it's not real clear in my mind just when they...
I didn't realize it had that much age. I thought it was something that came about in the 1970s, but much earlier than that is what you're saying.
Yes, but now there were points at which it was changed considerably. And I'm not sure just when these times were.
What else should I ask you about, Arnold? About the college and about the university?
I think you covered both my body of knowledge, and maybe I've said some things I didn't have very much knowledge of.
You said everything that I wanted to hear. Let me just add a couple of personal things that I'd like to get for the tape. You lost your first wife.
Yes.
And you remarried again to whom and when?
Rita Garris. And I'd have to check that date now.
We'll mark it in yellow for you to check and get your marriage date, because I don't want you to get into any trouble in case an anniversary is coming along.
That's right.
That you need to celebrate it all.
I know the anniversary is January the 27th.
Arnold, what have you done since you've retired?
Well, the first year or two after I retired, Sam, I worked with Andy McCullough on writing a history of banking in Florida for a 10-year period, 1970 to 1980, 71 to 81, something like that, for the Florida Bankers Association.
By the way, are their offices still in Orlando?
Yes, they're in the process of moving to Tallahassee, which I hate to see, because it places them right on the doorsteps of FSU.
Maybe something could happen to prevent that. So you for a couple of years you worked with McCullough then?
Yes.
Did that get done?
That got done.
Is that a published volume?
It's a published volume.
Is it part of a series on the history of banking in Florida or
yes.
just that?
It's, so far as I know, it's the last in the series that has been written. And
does it go back into the 19th century?
I think the original one may have.
Judd Dovell, you know, did an early history of banking in the 1950s.
Yeah, Judd and Jim Richardson got started on these things together.
Yeah.
Judd never could get Jim to write, I think. And he took it over for a while alone. And then someone down in Central Florida did one over a 10-year period. And we've done this one over a 10-year period.
And you brought yours, the one you did with McCullough, up to 1980?
Yes. 80, 81, somewhere along there.
Was this a major research writing job?
I thought it was, but it was not very creative. And I'm not sure really how much interesting history is involved, because either you have to do an awful lot to get the personalities involved, and I'm not sure you have available all the material you need for such things as Southeast effort to absorb the Florida National back in the, I think, 70s. And then there was other internal struggles similar to those. And it becomes sort of a largely relating of changes in the banking size, composition, mergers, offices, etc. And as a result, I really don't think we have achieved a great deal in writing out a volume.
What did you do after you finished this project with McCullough?
I haven't really done anything much. I had a heart attack, quadruple bypass in 84. Then, since then, I've had a hernia repair, and I've had an appendix. Ruptured appendix removed, and for the last three years, I've been struggling with Parkinson's.
You sound like a walking disaster. I mean, why would a man 38 years old get involved in all of these incidental kind of things?
Well, the doctor told me when I went to the emergency room with an ache in my right side, that you can't have appendicitis, you're too old.
You proved him wrong, didn't you, Arnold?
Well, he sent me home, Sam. And went back the next day, and he sent me home again. And then I went back towards the end of that week, and the doctor who sent me home the first time was off in North Carolina looking at colleges for his daughter. And they called in a new doctor. He said, "You have appendicitis," and proceeded to operate and took out my appendix plus about 6 inches of my large intestine.
And he was right then?
He was right.
The first one was wrong. What do you do with your time now? Are you a television watcher or a reader?
Well, I try to read, but I've been going through eye adjustment problems. And as soon as I get my glasses fixed where I can read out of them, they no longer compatible with my change in eyesight. And the moment I'm supposed to be on the list for a new doctor is leaving Shane and setting up practice in Gainesville to tighten up my eyelids. He goes, "I have a droop."
I hadn't noticed it, no.
Well, he says it won't help much, but it helps some.
You haven't had much chance to travel then as a result of all of these disasters for the last 10 years.
Yeah, and now my wife doesn't want to travel with me.
Well, I don't blame her at all. Why should she travel with a broken down guy? She can get somebody livelier than you.
That's not just the problem. The problem is she's afraid of what will happen.
Oh, well, yeah. Oh, I just thought she didn't want to be.
Another way of saying the same thing.
I thought she didn't want to be seen with an old guy.
Well, every once in a while we do run into someone who takes us to be father and daughter.
You see,